Blog Talk Radio.
All right, we are on the air with V-Spot. I'm going to be talking to James J. Dillon, former wrestling manager. He was the manager of the Four Horsemen during the group's prime era, which would have been with Flair, Arn, and Tully Blanchard, with Lex Luger, Barry Windham, and Ole Anderson over that period of time. He had had a very long career as a manager before the Horsemen, too, in different territories like Florida. And after that, he went to work for the World Wrestling Federation as head of talent relations. And eventually came back to WCW as an on-air role, and I'm not sure if it was actually a backstage role. I'd be curious to find out about that, too. He should be calling in about a minute to talk, and right now I'm just kind of having to kill time. Let's go check in with one of our sponsors.
Oh my god, that's a giraffe!
Sir, you can't keep that giraffe here.
Hey, it's not my giraffe!
Coming this fall, Bill White comes back from vacation and finds a surprise, a talking giraffe.
Mr. Dillon.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us. You know, it's funny, whenever I play the interstitial material, it always guarantees so it's going to call in right there immediately.
I guess I should feel important.
Yes, sir. Let me ask you, the first thing I was curious about, because I know you started out as a wrestler before going to being a manager. What led to that transition?
Well, actually, if you want to go all the way back, I mean, I started as a fan, like many other people that eventually got into the profession and, did everything from sell programs to carry ring jackets to help carry the ring parts a few times when they were shorthanded. And then one night when they were taping a television show in Philadelphia and no commissioned referee showed up due to a blizzard, I ended up being called upon to referee and did that on a part-time basis for 8 years. And it was a time that I thought that's maybe as far as my dream would carry me. But the Sheik came east to challenge Bruno Sammartino in the in the 60s. And anyway, after a conversation with him, he gave me a chance to come to Detroit and put on the tights, and that was the beginning of that. In 1971, just before turning 29 years old, I was given an opportunity to be booked by Crockett Promotions and went to Charlotte and never looked back from there. So I actually, a lot of people think of me as strictly the manager of the Four Horsemen, which was just a snapshot of my career that, actually, I had 3,200 and some odd wrestling matches through my career. So it was a transition from being a fan, referee, wrestler, and then the managing thing again was just something that got a call one day from the Mongolian Stomper and needed a manager, or something I'd never given any thought to, and jumped at the opportunity and then never looked back from there.
As a manager, were there things that caught you by surprise as a manager that you didn't expect when you were first starting?
I can't say that there was, because I think having been a referee for 8 years, having wrestled full time for 5 years before I ever even managed, I pretty much had some kind of experience on all levels. And so being a manager became very natural to me, because I was not blessed with a body like a Hulk Hogan or superstar Billy Graham or a Lex Luger. I was tall, a little on the lean side, but, presentable in the ring. But my strengths were my interviews. So it was a natural transition to utilize where my strongest skills were, which was on the mic. And, of course, that was a key ingredient to being a manager. But I can't really say that I had any surprises.
But was working as a referee, did that help you as a wrestler later on?
Yeah, absolutely, because back in those days there was no power plant or monster factory or developmental territories. There were no shortcuts into even getting into the business back in those days. You were independent contractors. There were no contracts. People moved from regional territory to regional territory, and the old-timers really weren't all that interested in helping a young guy break into the business because they looked at you as a potential threat to replace them if they helped you get into the business. So there was no easy route, and I always felt that to be a success from the era from which I came, you had to really love the business, which I did, have a desire that you weren't going to be discouraged by the disappointments that you have with any endeavor in life, and then beyond that, you needed a lot of help, and I had a lot of help from a lot of people over the years, and then even if you have talent and have desire and have people help you, the other ingredient is really just sheer luck of being the right place, the right time when an opportunity presents itself and recognizing that opportunity and being able to take advantage of it.
One thing I've been interested in with, as far as managers go, because I've noticed that some guys, you would think they might be good at it because they can talk, but then when it comes to actual being at ringside, and again, I can't put my finger on it.
I don't think there is any actual description of what is the ideal or successful manager. And if you look through the history of the business, there have been all kinds of different styles. I always figure that the greatest manager, in my opinion, was Bobby the Brain Heenan, who really could do it all. Bockwinkel will tell you himself that Bobby Heenan was Hall of Fame material just with his wrestling skills alone. And then as a manager, he could talk, very witty, entertaining. He and Gorilla Monsoon, to me, were one of the great announcing combinations of all time. But you see a Playboy Gary Hart, for those that remember him. Gary was more of a businessman type of approach, which is kind of the direction that I took, as opposed to, say, a Mouth of the South Jimmy Hart that ran around with colorful jackets and carrying a megaphone, or Jim Cornette that carried a tennis racket and basically talked nonstop. So everybody was successful when you start mentioning those names, and yet there was a great difference in styles.
Yeah. Is one of the things, the reason I was asking is because I'm curious about this, about knowing when to act and when not to, because I heard an interview with Tully Blanchard a couple of years ago, and he said as a wrestler he was always concerned with having a manager or valet because he said he worried that they might steal heat from him when they interfere, and he said it was a bigger problem with Baby Doll because he said that he always wanted to make sure if there was interference, like from you or from Baby Doll, that he would want like a weapon passed to him so it would be the heat would be on him.
Yeah, well, Tully is one of the greats of our business. I of the Four Horsemen, I think he was the really natural heel. After a while, the fans kind of, liked to hate us, but if there was anyone that had genuine heat, it was Tully. He just, whether it was his personality or his style or a combination of all of the above, and I never felt that Tully really got the credit he deserves for being the outstanding wrestler and performer that he was throughout his entire career. But my philosophy was always less is more, and that may have to do with the fact that I did have an extensive wrestling background, and I go back to wrestling in a lot of the smaller territories, and the business was always cyclical, where sometimes business was really good and you benefited in your paycheck, and sometimes things were not so good for a while and you had to tighten your belt because it was reflected in the money that you made. And anytime you were in a small territory that didn't have a big roster, if things got a little bit lean, I think it was human nature that the manager was the guy looking around figuring, well, the promoter's going to figure he has to have two guys to have a match, and he needs to have a third guy to be a referee, and if he's going to cut somewhere, where is he going to look first? And I think that motivated a lot of guys as managers to kind of do more than maybe they needed to focus attention on themselves so that they could project the feeling that maybe they were indispensable. And because I had the wrestling background, I never had that approach. I figured I had confidence, and again, less is more, that my job was not to distract from what was going on in the ring. My job was to complement it or to enhance it. People didn't buy a ticket to see me. I did interviews that helped further the story, but if it was Tully and Magnum, that's who the people paid to see. And I would sit there, and I might get up every now and then, but then sit back down, and when the people got lulled into thinking that I wasn't going to do anything, would maybe be when I would do one thing that might turn the tide of the match or have some influence in the outcome, and that was really my role. And the other thing that I did was, as I would sit there, I was into the match. If a guy like Tully was, getting the best of people, I was, very obviously cheering for him and proud. And the minute things got turned the other way, my emotions would show that too. And my logic was, if a guy sitting in the front row paid for a ticket, and our thought is that we do a good enough job in the ring that he gets excited and we see his emotion, if he looks over at me and I'm just sitting there and he sees no emotion for me, that why should he get excited? So
yeah,
I
exactly.
Felt that my part was to reflect what was going on just the same as if I was a fan, only I'm sitting there right there at ringside.
Right, you've got a personal stake in the matter too.
Absolutely.
With the Horsemen, and also before this, and I apologize if I don't have enough questions about Florida and stuff. It's like it's slightly before my time.
That's okay.
I've seen some stuff
if you get an opportunity, go to my website, jjdillon.com. And if you go to jjdillon.com, you'll see a pretty good history of my career. A lot of old pictures, and then later on in the fan cam part, I would go back and not thinking about it when you have a lengthy career like I do and you see these guys every night, you don't think about ever taking a picture or capturing a memory. And as the years went by and I would go to Cauliflower Alley Club, for example, or I'm on the board of the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame up in Amsterdam, New York, and when I go up there for the annual induction ceremony, or when I go to one of these fan festivals, like I was recently in Charlotte, I try to get pictures with different guys from different years that I've been with and post them as well. So the fans can not only see, my complete background, but they can see a lot of candid shots of some of the more current people that they might be more familiar with. And for those that might be interested in my autobiography that was published in 2005, Crowbar Press, and Scott Teal, who's a respected historian, who is a great author, too. He did Ole Anderson's book, Ahead of Mine, and he's done Ivan Koloff and Tony Atlas and Jody Hamilton, the assassin. A very impressive list, but if you go to jjdillon.com, you'll see wrestlers are like seagulls, and that'll take you to Crowbar Press, and you could see, all the books being offered. But I'm very proud of mine. Was never available in bookstores. People had to do a little work to find it. So I've always autographed copies for anybody that got the book. And the original hardcover printing was only 3,000. And I think at this point there's only a couple hundred left. So it's kind of been a well-kept secret, but if you look at the comments of those who have gotten the book and read it, I think that does more to give you an indication of what a good read it is than me telling you about all the chapters and the various portions of the book.
Yeah, I've heard great things about it. I've heard great things about it from different people that have actually read it.
Yeah, I had a very unique perspective from early 50s as a fan, or mid 50s, late 50s as a fan, through all the changes. I worked many of the regional territories as cable television changed the industry. I worked at a top executive level for Vince McMahon and also for WCW until they went out of business. So I basically had a unique perspective on the inside of the business that I share throughout my career. And it's also a pretty good history lesson as to the background of our business, and then an explanation of how the business operated. And even if you're not a diehard wrestling fan, it's a pretty nice feel-good story about a young teenager from New Jersey that fell in love with professional wrestling as a fan and had a dream that that's what he wanted to do. And not a lot of people, can say that they lived their dream, but I certainly did, and never, ever would have thought that I would be recognized by the WWE and their Hall of Fame, and then this year be inducted as part of the class of 2013 with the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame, which is certainly not as well known as the WWE Hall of Fame, but to me is the most prestigious honor because it's voted by the peers in your business, and that can be there can be no greater honor than that.
Going back to working with the Horsemen, when you were managing, was working with Flair different than working with Arn or Lex Luger or Tully?
Well, everybody had their own individual style, and I think what made it so successful, and again, it was a spontaneous thing. It wasn't like it was a creative idea that somebody had. It just happened around 1985 that Flair was the world heavyweight champion. Ole and Arn were world tag champions. Tully was the national champion, and this was after Baby Doll, so I was managing Tully at the time, and we were doing TBS, every Saturday afternoon at 6:05 for a two-hour show, and 1 week we all went out because we had all of the titles amongst the group, had all the gold belts, all the bragging rights, and, could talk about where we were going to be appearing that following week, and in the course of that interview, Arn said, take a good look at your screen because never have so few wreak so much havoc on everyone else that you need to go back in the history books to the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and held up four fingers. It was just something that he threw out as part of the comments that he made, and the fans are the ones that picked up on it, and we certainly had no idea that it was going to take off from there and that it would become as big as it became and last as long as it did. And again, it was certainly the pinnacle of my career. And whether I was out with Flair or with Tully or with Arn, and then, of course, Ole was late in his career as original Horseman, and he was the first one to spin away, which gave us a fresh opponent. And with Ole, everybody was already established star in the business. And I think just the chemistry of guys that were already at the peak of their careers had a lot to do with our success. And then when Luger came along, he was inexperienced, but we were established by then and were able to camouflage Lex's lack of experience. But yet we still had a great run with him. And then when Barry Windham turned and joined us, I think that was, in terms of bell-to-bell, the greatest grouping in terms of what we could do on any given night in the ring.
Yeah, the Yeah, the Barry Griff. That's the one that I started watching wrestling, you know, full, as a kid in 1988, where I can actually remember everything. And I was watching. I'm actually watching that TV right now, and that's like the such an impressive group. And it felt like when Barry became a horseman, it's like somehow it went into another gear. Somehow, you know, you think it, things are as good as they can get.
And yeah, it was it was a magical time in the business. And what's amazing is, I mean, you're talking about it being the time frame of when you first, you know, have your memories of the business. But there are people now that are, you know, looking at the history of the Horseman DVD, and because of YouTube and the WWE On Demand channel, and the fact that the various DVDs have been released, that there's now a current generation of fans being exposed to a product that's, you know, 25 years old, and yet it was so simple, so you know you didn't need to be a genius to follow it. It just was an athletic soap opera that just went from week to week, that wasn't very complicated, and you kind of knew who everybody was, and we just had a very loyal following, and the things that were entertaining 25 years ago, there's a new generation of fans looking at it now that's saying, wow, this is really great stuff.
How long in advance was it known that Barry was going to become a horseman?
You're talking about 25 years ago. To pinpoint exactly at what point the thing was made of approaching Barry and setting the thing up, it probably wasn't a great amount of time. But you hear about today's product where the WWE television is written, and then they get to the building an hour before the show, and Vince, for some reason, doesn't like what he sees, and they have a group of people who are not wrestling people scrambling trying to rewrite a whole program that's a three-hour live show. And back in the day, I mean, we were more episodic, going week to week, and when we did something, you know, we had some idea a week and 2 weeks out what we were going to do that was pretty well set in stone. And we just had such a tremendous run that we didn't have those, weeks that were bad, and we, you know, like, oh, well, how are we going to fix this? I mean, it just was so much talent. And the other thing is that when you look across the ring, you know, when you have Dusty Rhodes, who doesn't get enough credit for the great talent, great mind that he has been in the business, and the Road Warriors, and Magnum prior to his accident, and Ronnie Garvin, and the Boogie Woogie Man, Jimmy Valiant, and you look at the talent across the ring, Ivan and Nikita Koloff, the Midnight Express were there at the time, the Rock and Roll Express. I mean, there just was a wealth of talent in the business in that particular era. It was just a magical time I just have incredibly fond memories.
Yeah, the reason I was asking was because I remember that I thought it was foreshadowed really well. I remember I was watching the TV in January, and you kind of had these hints that Barry might actually turn, and you would get them every now and then. It wouldn't beat you over the head with it, but you'd have these little hints that something was going on, and that's why I was asking.
Yeah, I think when it actually happened, it shocked people. I mean, that's the comment that I hear, that that they really didn't see it coming. And when it happened, it happened. And it happened big time and with great impact. And we were innovators, too. When you think of what was interesting, too, is a lot of times there have been either individual wrestlers or what have you that have been red hot in the industry, that at the first time that they get beat, you know, they lose their edge and they're never the hot commodity that they once were. And we were so hot at the time that we were going out there every week getting beat up, oftentimes soaked in our own blood, if we could get back on TV and still have the belts and then give our spin on what took place, you know, the fans, you know, would look at us and say, well, they got their butts kicked and, you know, I guess they just didn't get them kicked bad enough, and next time they're going to get it worse than they got it this week. And so we were able to go out and lose more often than we won and still have the people want to pay to see it more and more. And then every now and then, like the ambush where we got Dusty in the parking lot and broke his arm, I mean, there were people that were angry that wanted us to be arrested for assault and get criminal charges, and that one episode, you know, was talked about and gave us momentum for 6 months to a year after that. So we didn't need to do much, and when we did do something, it was impactful and contributed to our longevity.
It's remarkable when I watch this stuff, you know, because number one, I can still watch it. Like, I love Tully Blanchard, but I can watch him wrestle, and to this day, I still want to see him get his head bashed in. You know, the horseman. I mean, and I know logically, you know, it's like years later. I like it. I like watching him wrestle, but when you interfere, I still want somebody to pop you in the face.
Yeah, well,
like, you know,
people come around, and we were insulated from the fans back in the day. I mean, we would come in the back door of the arena and go to the dressing room, have our match, leave, and unless there was a chance meeting at a convenience store on the way out of town or something, for the most part, we had very minimal interaction with the fans. And so I think that's contributed in a big part to the popularity of some of these fan fests. And I live here in Delaware, and there's a Legends of the Ring that's got one coming up, and it's like number 17, and they bring in all the big stars, and just like Greg Price with the fan fest that he's had such success with in Charlotte, and you know, people that come to Cauliflower Alley Club every year in Vegas or come to the induction of the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, it gives them a chance to actually interact with us. To get to know us one-to-one and share their memories, because their memories are our memories. And a lot of times the people will come up to you and say, you know, I hated your guts. And to me, that tells me that I must have been doing my job very well at the time for them to have that feeling. And yet they come back with, you know, very positive memories of the distraction that it was to the problems of their daily life at that time. They came to forget about their problems with us, and we were able to do that for them, and they bring their kids who have no idea who we are, other than, like I say, DVDs and YouTube and these other things that people are able to go back and relive these memories.
I meant to ask about this. You won Manager of the Year for Pro Wrestling Illustrated, I believe, 3 times, and I have the 88 issue. I recently got it, and the picture they used of you holding you're hugging the plaque, which I thought that was priceless. Was that a big deal for you to win Manager of the Year?
Yeah, I won 3 times the Pro Wrestling Illustrated. And actually, there was another major magazine called The Main Event, and I was their Manager of the Year in 1988 as well. So I actually have a dual award, and as I sit here on the phone conducting this interview with you, I'm looking at those plaques that I still have to this day, and I have them displayed on the wall along with my Hall of Fame plaque from the WWE and my Hall of Fame plaque from this year from the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. So I'm very proud of the honors that I've received throughout my career, and certainly the recognition with Hall of Fame and having 2 Hall of Fame rings kind of validates, you know, my body of work over almost a half century, my whole adult life.
But honestly, if you're looking at it, you know, from a pure story standpoint, you should have won in 87, too. You know, like, if you're just looking at the scoreboard, you know, the Horsemen dominated every title in the NWA for 2 years. Or, actually, longer. Are you still on?
Do you have another question? I think I'm going to
lost. Yes, sir. I'm sorry. Let me ask you, when Lex Luger left the Horsemen, the angle that they did that with the Bunkhouse Stampede, where he wouldn't let you win, you know, I saw the interviews on the TV, and I remember, you know, just thinking this recently when I was watching, I came across the idea that you were completely justified in kicking Luger out. But when that happened, so was it planned on Luger, when he first came into the Horsemen, was there an exact date they planned that you knew that where he was going to be leaving to take on Flair? Apparently we've lost contact, unfortunately. Let me give it a few minutes, see if he'll call back in. Let's just play something right now and just give it a minute, see if he can call back in.
I've been having trouble getting to sleep.
You should try Sounds of the Sea, the soundtrack of ocean sounds, guaranteed to get you to sleep. Hey, are we far enough out yet?
We're 60 miles off the coast. We should be well into international waters.
All right, I got the chickens. First we'll fuck them, then have them fight before we cook them both.
Hey, save some room for this mess I'm cooking up.
That's Sounds of the Sea, available for 5 easy payments of $29.95 plus shipping and handling. P.O. Box, Buckabee, Iowa, 69, Backdoor Way. Sorry, no COD.